Chapter 56. The explosion came like a curiously muffled clap of thunder. The forward mass of the glacier creaked and groaned ominously. Then nothing appeared to happen. The ice cliff remained firm and upright. Detonations should have occurred at 8 different locations inside the fracture, but Major Dillinger and his men had discovered and disarmed all but one charge before their search was cut off. The distant thump came just as Pitt and Gunn were closing in on the two hijackers who were busily firing up the old mine locomotive. The hijackers paused, listening for a few moments, exchanging words in Arabic. Then they laughed between themselves and turned back to their work. "Whatever caused the boom," whispered Gunn, "came as no surprise to those guys. They act as if they expected it."
"Sounded like a small explosion," Pitt replied softly.
"Definitely not the glacier breaking away. We'd have felt tremors in the ground."
Pitt stared at the small, narrow-gauge locomotive, which was coupled to a coal tender and 5 ore cars. It was a type used around plantations, industrial plants, and mining operations. Quaint, stout, and sturdy, with a tall stovepipe smokestack and round porthole windows in the cab, it looked like the little engine that could, standing there puffing wisps of steam around its running gear. A railroad man would have classed the wheel arrangement as an 040, indicating no leading truck wheels followed by 4 drive wheels with no trailing truck beneath the cab.
"Let's give the engineer and his fireman a warm send-off," Pitt murmured dryly. "It's the friendly thing to do."
Gunn looked at Pitt queerly and shook his head in bewilderment before crouching and running toward the end of the train. They split up and approached from opposite sides, taking cover under the ore cars. The cab was brightly illuminated by the open firebox, and Pitt gestured with an upturned palm, signaling Gunn to wait. The Arab who acted as engineer was busy turning valves and watching the steam pressure gauges. The other shoveled coal from the tender across the platform into the flames. He fed a load of the black lumps onto the fiercely burning firebox, paused to mop his sweating face, and then slammed the door to the firebox shut with his shovel, sending the cab into a state of semi-darkness. Pitt pointed at Gunn and then at the engineer. Gunn waved an acknowledgement, grasped the grab irons, and leapt up the steps into the cab. Pitt arrived first. He calmly approached the fireman head-on and said pleasantly, "Have a nice day." Before the confused and astonished fireman could respond, Pitt had swiftly snatched the shovel out of the Arab's hands and beat him over the head with it. The engineer was in the act of turning around when Gunn whipped him across the jaw with the heavy silencer joined to the Heckler & Koch's stubby muzzle. The Arab dropped like a bag of cement. While Gunn guarded against intruders, Pitt propped both hijackers so they hung half out of the cab's side windows. Next, he thoughtfully studied the maze of pipes, levers, and valves.
"You'll never do it," Gunn said, shaking his head.
"I know how to start and drive a Stanley steamer," Pitt said indignantly.
"A what?"
"An antique automobile," Pitt answered. "Pull open the door to the firebox. I need some light to read the gauges." Gunn did as he was asked and held out his hands to warm them from the flames leaping through the opening. "You better figure it out quick," he said impatiently. "We're lit up like a Las Vegas chorus line." Pitt pulled down a long lever and the little engine slipped forward a scant centimeter. "Okay, that's the brake. I think I've figured what handle does what. Now when we roll past the crushing mill, jump and hustle inside."
"What about the train?"
"The Cannonball Express," Pitt replied with a wide grin, "does not make stops." Pitt released the ratchet on the forward reverse lever and pushed it away from him. Next, he squeezed the ratchet on the throttle bar and eased it open. The locomotive crept slowly ahead, accompanied by the clanging jerk of the coupled ore cars. He shoved the throttle to its stop. The drive wheels whirled full circle several times before they bit the rusty rails. The train lurched forward and got underway. The labored puffing came in faster spurts as the little engine picked up speed and chugged by the front of the dining hall. The door opened and a hijacker leaned out and raised a hand as if to wave. He snapped it back down when he saw the two bodies leaning from the cab's side windows. He disappeared into the building as if jerked by an immense rubber band, wildly shouting a warning. Pitt and Gunn both unleashed a blast of gunfire through the windows and door of the building. Then the engine was passed and heading toward the crushing mill.
Pitt glanced at the ground and judged the speed to be somewhere between 15 and 20 kilometers. Pitt pulled the overhead whistle lever and tied it down with a drawstring from inside his ski jacket. The spurt of steam through the brass whistle cut the air like a razor. "Get ready to jump," he yelled at Gunn above the ear-splitting scream. Gunn didn't reply. He stared at the rough gravel flashing past as though it were hurtling by at jet speed 1,000 meters below. "Now!" shouted Pitt. They hit the ground on the run, skidding and sliding but somehow managing to keep their footing. There was no hesitation, no pause to catch their breath. They ran alongside the train and straight up the steps of the crushing mill stairs, and didn't stop until they both stumbled, then tripped over the threshold and crashed to the floor inside. The first thing Pitt saw was Giordino standing above him, unconcernedly holding his machine gun in a muzzle-up position. "I've seen you kicked out of some pretty raunchy pubs," Giordino said in a dour voice, "but this is the first time I've ever seen you tossed off a train." "No great loss," said Pitt, coming to his feet. "It didn't have a club car." "The gunfire, yours or theirs?"
"Ours."
"Company on the way?" "Like mad hornets out of a vandalized nest," replied Pitt. "We don't have much time to prepare for a siege. They'd better be careful where they aim or their helicopter might get broken. An advantage we'll play to the hilt." Findlay had finished tying the guard and the two mechanics together in the center of the floor, and he stood up.
"Where do you want them?"
"They're as safe as anywhere there on the floor," answered Pitt. He looked swiftly around at the cavernous interior of the building with the crushing mill squatting in the center. "Al, you and Findlay grab whatever equipment or furniture you can lift and convert the ore crusher into a fort. Rudy and I will delay them as long as we can."
"A fort within a fort," said Findlay.
"It would take 20 men to defend a building this big," Pitt explained. "The hijackers' only hope of capturing their helicopter intact is to blow the main door and rush us en masse. We'll pick off as many as we can from the windows and then retreat to the mill for a last-ditch defense." "Now I can sympathize with Davy Crockett at the Alamo," moaned Giordino. Findlay and Giordino began fortifying the huge mill, while Pitt and Gunn set up shop at windows on opposite corners of the building. The sun was beginning to cast its rays over the slopes on the other side of the mountain. Darkness was almost gone. Pitt could feel the wave of anxiety that washed through his mind. They might prevent the Arabs who were rapidly surrounding the crushing mill from escaping, but if the hijackers on the ship eluded the special forces teams and made a run for the mine, he and his pitiful little force would be overwhelmed. He looked darkly out the window at the little engine as it roared down the track on its final run, picking up momentum with every turn of its drive wheels. Sparks belched from the stack as a long plume of smoke trailed sideways, driven by a flanking wind. The ore cars rattled and swayed on the narrow rails. The sound of the whistle turned from a shrill shriek to the mournful wail of a lost soul in hell as the train hurtled into the distance.